Redwood Soundwave.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Watch No Evil. This is Zach.
Yeah, this is Matt.
And Matt's drunk.
You
sounded sauced.
2 o'clock on a Monday.
Well.
And it's Martin Luther King Day.
Listen, I don't know how you celebrate. And today we're going to be talking about the 1978 remake Invasion of the Body Snatchers, a story originally by Jack Finney, this time directed by Philip Kaufman, featuring Donald Sutherland, Brooke Adams, Leonard Nimoy, and Jeff Goldblum. This is kind of an ensemble sci-fi plant-based horror film, but also kind of like doppelganger, as the name implies. And this is actually probably like in my top five horror movie, overall franchises. Like I have actually, since watching this one again, gone back and watched the original film and also the 90s remake. All of them have kind of the same ideas in them, adapted and manipulated in different ways to kind of fit the current social climate. They're all very interesting in their own ways. This one remains my favorite so far, but Matt, what is your history with this franchise and with this film in particular?
I like all of the movies in the franchise, but I especially like the 2000s one with Nicole Kidman. Right?
That's the only one I have not seen. Yeah, it's with Nicole Kidman. That's the only one I have not seen. Is that one about the environment?
I don't necessarily think so. It would kind of make sense. It fit really nicely into that kind of mid-2000s, mid-aughts, almost apocalypse vibe. There's something very similar in the cinematic direction as I Am Legend, but also as The Happening, where it's this kind of blanket apocalypse movie. There is this really interesting adoption subplot in that movie, but yeah, I think that one is one of my favorites. I just like it a lot. I've seen it probably the second most after the very original one is obviously anti-communist.
It was like 56 or something. It was very much of that.
Yeah. Time. Because the talking points, the anti-communist talking points are always just like, oh, everyone is the same, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. And that lack of individuality is bad. And then you get into like more contemporary readings of it. And it's like, well, what is the lack of agency and what is the violence that is kind of used against people in a vehicle to get them in line? Like, we don't see that as being a good thing. We see kind of the radical humanism of being both good and bad people as being equally important. So I mm-hmm. almost at times got like a little bit of like anti-military, anti-war vibes for the 70s one.
That's really like, in my opinion, what the 90s one is about, because it takes place on a military base. And there's like a lot of body horror to it, which is like kind of, in my opinion, hinting at kind of like just the overall like graphic nature and like just terrible like visceral carnage of war. But also like there is this kind of emphasis on like the detached emotions that you see in the body snatchers and like how it kind of interwoven into like the fabric of military training. The 90s one is much more about that. I think this one in particular that we're talking about today is squarely between the 50s and the 90s versions. And I think that like thematically and analogously, like kind of wedges itself right between those two.
Yeah, I mean, would this have been related at all to the Vietnam War?
That it's tough because I think that the 70s, it's almost like this is like swinging back from the communism ideas, because like the 70s was this era, like it came right after the 60s of like, you know, the free love. There's
the rise of cults.
Right, the rise of cults and then the Jonestown Massacre. This is kind of like coming off the heels of that, and all these movies have like very cohesive social messages to them. And this one seems to be like the just overall like sense of individuality. Like in the 60s and the 70s, people were like starting to become a little bit more accepting of like worldly ways. Like you see Donald Sutherland's character, you know, he's like cooking with a wok and he's like this health inspector like that goes from restaurant to restaurant, like different cuisines are available. You see that kind of like proliferation of American culture and like acceptance of worldwide culture here as well. And especially because like it also takes place in California, which, you know, is definitely an epicenter for that free love and also like the protests of Vietnam. So I think all those ideas are there and kind of explored in some way, or at least mentioned in this film. And I think that's all just to like, you know, put those ideas in our heads and like, okay, none of this actually would matter anymore because there is this hive mind that is just taking over and making us lose this sense of individuality and making, like, stripping us of our humanity. I think that's really what they explore in all these films, is like this stripping of humanity. That's, I think, the core horror of it, is they emphasize there's no need for love anymore. There's no need for hate. There is, I think, like an emphasis in each of these films of like, that's kind of what makes human nature beautiful, is, you know, you have the love, but also there's the hate as well, and everything that goes along with all the emotions, instead of this, like, just shell of an existence.
To boil down all of the things that you're saying, love is so great that it's worth hate existing for love to exist.
Yeah, it's like the whole cheesy, like, light wouldn't exist without the darkness, you know?
I think that my favorite part of this movie is actually when Elizabeth is anxious about her fiancé having changed, and it is asked of her if he's become gay or Republican. I enjoyed that part.
That was Leonard Nimoy's character, right?
It's a joke. But the whole thing is a joke. It's a joke to the audience, and I thought it was funny. Yeah, and so my point being, I don't know that would have had the same impact it does now.
No.
But now it's very funny.
It was very serious. I think the way that he presented it was like, you know, giving the idea of like these fundamental personality changes.
Right, and so much of what he's about is pseudo-psychology.
Right, and that's supposed to be like kind of what his character is. Like he's the Dr. Phil, you know, he's like writing these books, and that's like how he's gathered his fame. It's not necessarily through the credence of his work. It's just he wrote a book and people know him as a celebrity.
Yeah, and it's about the homogenization of society, because he is trying to fix marriages to be a particular way. It kind of reminds me of the guy who wrote about the love languages.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
Which is, as everybody knows, just like, oh, love languages. And first of all, core love languages are, for the man, physical touch, which means convincing the wife to have sex, which is never good. And for the wife, it's acts of service, because for whatever reason, that sect of people think that a man equally participating in like household chores is an act of service to the woman in the relationship. There's a lot of hokum that goes into the love languages things, and while there is like, of course, some merit to it, to me, that's what Dr. Kibner, Leonard Nimoy's character, is. He is trying to boil down every single relationship and marriage in the United States into this, like, this is what the marriage should be to best fit society. Dr. David Kibner, you know, there is a psychoanalytical perspective, but we also don't see him outside of the Dr. Phil characteristic.
He gives Elizabeth, like, a sedative, and that's the only, like, actual doctorly thing that he does.
Yeah, and that's even after he's been taken.
I think that he was snatched, like, the whole time.
Yeah, I agree, but I don't think that him having the sedative is indicative of him being a doctor. I think him having the sedative is indicative of this is the access that they all have, because
look
at the military tanks and all that stuff, and it's just like, they just got a doctor to do it.
Yeah.
That being said, with all of this movie going on, I love at the beginning of horror movies that are not inherently Christianity, they still show a priest in juxtaposition to the bad thing, just so that you know it's partially God's fault. Because the opening scene, after it shows kind of the, you know, the mitosis of this little almost fleshy plant creature on the branch, the kids walk by, and then it's the image that lingers for a while of a priest swinging on a swing set with a small child, and it just is on his face for a significant period of time, and I'm just like, he does not have any other importance throughout this movie other than for you to know that the clergy might be involved.
So I think that might just be like here's the different slices of life, and like here's the effects of what is about to come. It's like no one's exempt from it, you know. That's kind of how I read that. But
well, I think that with any of these, you at the end of it have to have some sort of explanation, and a lot of movies because they can't come up with like a scientific background, and this is science fiction, it never takes like a purely scientific point of view.
I like that about it.
I do too. It just kind of says like, this was an act of God, which act of, you know, the act of God is the impetus for a lot of things that happen in movies. And I think that this one is not exempt from it being an act of God, versus like, you know, take The Thing, where they're like, this is an alien that was deposited in Earth's ice that then was brought out and resurrected once it was heated up. Right. Even in other iterations of this, they have like a, this is where this came from, and this is how the science of the creature came to be. And I think a lot of science fiction is really focused on the science of how those monsters, while this one is just kind of like, nope, act of God, wash our hands, let's get to the story. And I appreciate that, actually, that it just kind of jumps into the story.
I think it largely glazes over that, because there wasn't too much time between the original film and this one. I think people were more or less aware and familiar with the idea. Everything that is shown in the intro credits, it shows those like the little life forms coming from outer space, and then it shows these images of clouds, shows it raining onto plants. It really gives us like the transference of these beings, and how like it actually come in contact with humans, and actually like introduced into the human race. And they do spend quite a bit of time exploring the origins of it, and like, you know, they show the characters kind of like figuring it out. Oh, it's in the plants, and you know, it's, oh hey, sniff this flower. Like Jeff Goldblum's character just doesn't want to stop sniffing the flowers. And I think that they do spend a lot of time with it, maybe a little bit too much time, but at the same time, they don't like overbake the idea. That's like, okay, they don't underestimate their audience. Like a lot of,
they don't answer it.
Well, yeah, and they don't answer why it came to Earth. I guess is like the point you're making, right? Is,
yeah, and I don't think it cares. I think that one of the trademark differences between this and the original film is, yes, this is an ensemble piece, but at the end of the day, it's also a love story between Donald Sutherland and Brooke Adams.
A very tragic one.
Yeah.
That's done really well. That's actually probably one of my favorite parts of this movie, is just like how that ends up and doesn't, like, you think that they're going to make it. You get this, I know I'm kind of like skipping to the end now, but that's one of my favorite parts of this movie. And that's always, I would think that most people are the same, but like when I think of this movie, I think of that scene where they're like kind of in the brush and they're like, hey, look, the ships, and they hear one of the ships playing Amazing Grace with like bagpipes, and that is just such a beautiful moment. And it's like this false hope, because then, you know, it's just like going over the radio and they find out, no, these people on these ships have also been invaded. And it's so good. And then he goes back and Elizabeth has been assimilated. Like, it's so good and so tragic. And like, it creates this universe and creates this really prevalent sense of hope throughout. You have so much of them like slipping out of close calls, and like the tension builds the whole time, only to find out at the end, no one makes it. The only one who does make it is
Veronica Cartwright, Nancy.
Yeah, she's the only one that makes it. But at the very end, you get that image of Donald Sutherland pointing at the camera and shrieking. And it's like, yeah, she's doomed. It's something that this whole franchise does very well. It's like this building of tension, and there is really no release of it. At the end, it's like, okay, well, the release is, we just have to give up. And that's really what the whole idea of it is.
Yeah, because I don't think that they figure out a way to reverse it. And I think that when you are looking at these, that a lot of them have super nihilistic endings. I would say, with exception, the most recent one, the 2007, does not have a nihilistic ending, a positive ending. And that is very, very important, because if you take a look at the first one, it ends, but it is not complete.
It's pretty dark looking.
it's dark looking, but it's not yet complete. It is talking about kind of the horror to come as well.
Right.
And I think with the 1978 version, you're really looking at the horror is now the contemporary. It is kind of achieved its goal overall. So there's not really a lot to expect of the aftermath of this, right? We assume that Veronica, you know, Nancy Belichick, gets dragged away and becomes a pod person.
Think about this in juxtaposition to like basically any zombie movie or franchise. This is kind of like a zombie apocalypse movie, but first of all, mental zombies, it's like a hive mind thing, and everyone's just kind of like going about their normal business. They show Donald Sutherland's character at the end. He's just going about his business again as a health inspector, even though he's been assimilated. And this is like kind of the before zombie apocalypse, or I guess during zombie apocalypse, rather than in a lot of zombie movies, we see the aftermath. We see, hey, there's a bunch of zombies everywhere. Here's like a handful of survivors that are just trying to get by. This is, yeah. I think, scarier. The horror is happening in front of you rather than like, it has happened and now we just have to avoid it.
Yeah, and there's no way to really avoid it.
Any single person is like, and there's no way to see, right? You look at a zombie, it's like, okay, well, they're infected.
and unintelligent.
Right. Whereas
these are clearly intelligent.
Yeah, they just have better posture than the average person.
Yeah. It has a lot of connections with basically most sci-fi of the period, the original version, the 1956 version, because it also reminds me so much of The Day the Earth Stood Still, right? Which is, mm-hmm. The movie is about aliens that come and that they have judged Earth as being self-destructive, and they no longer want Earth to be self-destructive, and things have to change. Otherwise, they're going to destroy the Earth, right? And I think that part of that was in response to, you know, nuclear pressures.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a similar kind of message, which is peace must prevail. And even in that movie, they're like, no. And in this one, they're just like, oh, yeah, peace prevailing is bad. And because that's what the society that the invasion has built. It is a peaceful society.
Mm-hmm.
Although, can you really call it a peaceful society in the absence of war, right? Or, like, what makes it a peaceful society if it's a society that doesn't really have anything to it?
And they don't show it being any better at the end. Like, we see, and it was kind of weird, is like, it's all bright and sunny
exactly
for, like, the first...
Exactly the same.
Right, it's the same, except it's all, like, bright and sunny for basically the first time in the movie. We don't really get, like, these nice bright shots until the end. So it, like, kind of paints it as this utopia, but, like, it ending with that pointing, shrieking Donald Sutherland, it's like, that just ruins it all.
Yeah, it makes it seem like the peacefulness is a facade.
Right.
Because underneath the peacefulness, there is violence against the other. I mean, you could do an entire reading of this as xenophobia, too.
Right, it's like, hey, you don't think like us, you're going to become one of us. It's not even like, I guess you technically die.
Yeah, you die. You don't become one. A pod just kind of becomes what you look like, and then you turn to dust. Which is, it dehydrates them.
But it retains the memories, and like, yeah. they say, like, the DNA or whatever.
Yeah, it sucks their brain liquid out.
Which is, okay, we gotta give Jack Finney the credit, right? That's such, like, a brilliant idea. It's like, we get doppelganger stuff. It's, like, really folklore at this point. But this is such a creative way to do it, and I really like it.
I like that it also kills them, and they're just like, no, they're dead now. That person is not fixable.
Well, you brought up the thing earlier. I think it's important for us to mention that Jack Finney also wrote Who Goes There, which is the basis for the thing. So, like, he's the sci-fi body horror guy.
He's the stolen identity guy.
Right, and it's like, it's just so cool that he came up with these two ideas that are pretty similar, but so unique in, like, their execution, that it's like, you don't hear people talking about The Thing and Invasion of the Body Snatchers in the same sentence all that much. They're just completely different atmospheres, which is, I think, like, really the biggest difference of it. It's like, here, it's kind of just avoidance.
Yes.
And whereas The Thing, it's very much, let's find this thing and root it out.
Yeah, it takes two different perspectives, which is the intimate and interpersonal relationships, and then the broad and global extrapersonal relationships. So it's just like, these are two people who have to work together to try and survive, versus The Thing, which is very much every man for himself, trust no one.
Which I think carries into the social messaging of both of them, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Between, you know, like, kind of like the Lavender Scare, which we talked about in both of our episodes on The Thing and any ensuing sequels / remakes. But with this, and with any iteration of this, it's different social messaging, really more of a global thing. It has to do more with, like, socio political messages. Oh, did you know that the director of the original film is the taxi driver in this movie?
Yeah. Yeah, and Kevin McCarthy is the guy who runs up and splats onto the hood of the car and is just like, whoa!
Yep, he did. That's such a good scene, too. Where they just slowly drive by and you like get that shot through the window of the car. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's so
slow. The dead body. Yeah, it's great. This is a very well done movie for the time that it came out and for just the quality of storytelling. I think that you have to give it to this. It doesn't feel like a dated way of telling this story. Obviously, like, the setting and the cinematography, and it's obviously old just by the look of the film that it's shot on, but it is not dated really in any way. And I think that that's hard to do.
I think in a lot of ways, this is actually more of a modern cinematic experience than the 90s version. I think it's just called The Body Snatchers.
Right, yeah.
Just the atmosphere of it seems much more modern. To me, it kind of reminds me of It Follows in the way that it builds as atmosphere and tension. Whereas the 90s one is like, much more explosions and we have to shoot these things, and like you only see like a handful of these pods die. A lot of the time they're not even fully formed yet. It's Matthew just whacking them with a shovel or like chopping them up with the shovel or burning them in that like facility at the end. But there's really not this mentality of let's fight back.
Because I think that with these kinds of movies you run into this issue of these look like people. We know that they're not people, but they look like people. And specifically, they look like people that we know. And they have a lot more humanity than the typical zombie storytelling. Because, I mean, watch any zombie movie where the loved one of the main character gets turned. And there's this like intense emotional moment where they have to choose between like running away and leaving them to be zombie forever or to kill them. And in many cases the treatment is like, oh well, killing them is more humane because they wouldn't want to be a zombie and they wouldn't want to do damage or harm to other people. Whereas in this movie they have to really reckon with the fact that not only are their loved ones turning into something or someone that is visually identical to them, but is in general a different person, but has the same memories and has the same level of sentience. Like, how can you fight back against that?
Right.
I think that that's a really difficult thing for a human empathetic person to do, because not only are they seeing this person, but that person can directly say like, no, I don't want you to kill me because I've been turned into this. I love being this. This is great.
Right. Well, and really the fundamental difference in this person now is that they're going to try to convince you to become assimilated. Right.
Yeah.
And like, we see that a few times, like, oh no, this is better. And you know, you don't feel like you did before. You don't feel like the pain and all that. It's so, like, can you think of a more painful thing? Like, this person wants me to die. This person that I loved wants me to die. They still have all those memories. They just feel differently. It's so strange. And like, you don't get that in zombie movies, right? Zombies are just like, hey, I want to eat brains. I think it's Elizabeth, Elizabeth Pod, she says to Matthew, the function of life is to survive. So these guys, these pods are very utilitarian.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we don't know why they've come to Earth, like we mentioned. It's like, maybe it's just to survive, and like, this is that they've decided the best way to survive is to completely take over Earth and become this hive mind. And just, I can see this turning into a very environmental message. I think if we get a remake anytime soon, it's going to be about global warming and like saving the planet. Honestly, maybe a hive mind wouldn't be a bad idea with the situation that we're in. We all just get taken over and this plant species decides to make the world more habitable so that they can survive themselves, because clearly we don't have that instinct.
Yeah, it's like, the biggest thing that it does is it gets rid of the idea of greed, I suppose. Like,
conflict altogether.
Yeah, and honestly, like, that's, I think, if they made it now, I just feel like, especially with this generation of young people,
millennials are like, yes, please invade us.
Yeah, well, because I think that it's the same trend as zombie movies, which is initially when zombie movies were making a popularity rise back in the 2000s and the 2010s, people were just like, their response to the zombification of others was not, I'm gonna be the lone survivor, in the which is what it was in the 90s and 80s. People were just like, yeah, if the zombie apocalypse happens, I'm gonna be ready. I'm gonna be prepared. I'm gonna have weapons. I know not to use guns because guns run out of ammunition. So I'll have not, like, they had the zombie survival guides, right? There was like hugely popular. And then we kind of hit the point where especially millennials and Gen Z were just like, yeah, if there's a zombie apocalypse, I'm killing myself. Yeah. And so now it's like with these movies, I feel it's the same thing. If you were to tell me that something was going to come into my life, make me no longer feel anxiety, depression, and know that for the rest of my living experience, I'm going to have basic needs fulfilled, I'm not going to have to worry about famine, debt, hunger, etc., I'd be like, yeah, sign me up.
Sounds great.
I'll join this MLM. Like,
I don't even know, like, do they have to eat, or are they actual plants? They're just like,
I don't know. They might photosynthesize.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that we've now hit kind of the end of the parabola where people are being like, well, is it maybe that bad? Like, I don't know. I don't know if it's that bad anymore.
Let them invade. Please take me.
As we experience a constant loss of autonomy with exclusively positives seems better than loss of autonomy where we can't push back against it.
Yeah, really, I think the only thing that kind of presents itself as a negative is the banjo man dog thing. They showed the guy who's, you know, in the park playing banjo, and he's got his dog with him, and the pod messed up, right? The pod has created this man dog thing that it doesn't even like play banjo, it just makes banjo noises. Like, that's its way of communicating. And so I think that is really the only piece of evidence that's like, this alien species, it might not be
perfect.
Yeah, it might not be this perfect, like, planned out thing, and like, there is fault to it. There is, you know, kind of, that adds to the body horror, right?
Yeah.
I think that definitely like pulls us in the right direction, at least as a modern audience, of like, okay, this is a bad thing. It's not something that we should be hoping happens. I think that that's actually, like, that moment is when Elizabeth and Matthew are, like, pretending to be assimilated.
Yes.
And that's, like, kind of what makes Elizabeth scream and reveal them. Because, like, the pod wouldn't have screamed at that. It would have been like, yeah, this one messed up. It's fine. Yeah, I think it was a nice, like, body horror take on what happened to the original when they're going through. It's basically the same two characters. They just have different names. They're like walking around pretending to be the pods, but it's a dog almost gets hit by like a garbage truck, and the woman is like, no, and that show of emotion is what reveals them. And I think that this is just the fact that it still involves a dog is like kind of taking a nod to that older version, but also modernizing it and making it just a little bit more skeezy and creepy.
Yeah.
Which we love.
Thank you everyone for listening to this week's episode of Watch No Evil. This is Matt.
And this is Zach.
And remember, what's mine is yours, and what's yours is soon to be pod.
All becomes pod.
There's no Matt, only pod. There is no Zool, only pod.
That's it. That's the one. We got there.
Check out all the podcasts brought to you by Redwood Sound Labs. Finally, a podcast that's dedicated to talking about your favorite sports movies. Whether you want to hear a breakdown of the plot, arguments about who's the MVP of the film, or crit and lit about it, you'll find it all on Fields of Glory. Listen to the show that will help you live a better life with your beloved pets. It handles topics like proper food, nutrition, positive reinforcement training, and more. Certified dog behavior consultant Charlotte Peltz welcomes your pet concerns and questions in the podcast Living with Your Dog. Zach and Matt are two horror movie enthusiasts of varying experience discussing horror movies through the scope of content, context, and comedy. They'll hit on the good ones and the classics, but they're really excited for the bad ones. Listen to Watch No Evil. Charles is a Purple Heart recipient and cinematographer. Aaron is a professor and critical cultural scholar. Together, they explore the narrative, effective, and production politics of war cinema on the Real War Project. That's REEL, War Project.